It's a beautiful day and a fine time for healing. Podcast host Randy Fine, a narcissistic abuse expert and the author of the groundbreaking book Close Encounters of the Worst Kind and the captivating memoir Cliff Edge Road, invites you into her sanctuary, a place where your physical, emotional, and spiritual well-being are all that matter. So put your feet up, relax, and enjoy today's show. And now, here's Randy.
Good morning. Thank you for tuning in to listen to A Fine Time for Healing. I am your talk show host, Randy Fine. In December of 1988, today's special guest, Susie Levin, and her 7-year-old daughter, Lauren, were forced into the trunk of a car for hours in the searing Florida heat. Susie's new husband, Alan, was taken in another car on an hour-long drive to the bank, of which he was chairman and CEO, to withdraw ransom money from a safe. Three perpetrators had forced their way into the home the previous afternoon, holding Lauren and housekeeper Petrona captive under the guise of delivering Christmas poinsettia. They later ambushed Susie and Alan at the door as they returned late at night from a meeting. As time in the trunk passed, struggling to live, Susie experienced a near-death experience, visiting heaven and coming back, from which she emerged a radically changed human being. Because Susie came back, she understood this to be a powerful tool to conduct herself differently in the world. Susie tells the story in her book, Getting to Forgiveness, What a Near-Death Experience Can Teach Us About Loss, Resilience, and Love. She shares how she emerged as a stronger soul after her unique life events, blending spiritual thought-provoking lessons, meaningful insights, and life lessons of gratitude, forgiveness, and acceptance. In addition to being an author, Susie is a community leader, philanthropist, and founder of the Work-Life Balance Institute for Women. Susie and her husband, Alan, are co-founders of the Susie and Alan Levin NSU Ambassadors Board. I know you want to hear Susie's story, so I'm going to bring her on, and we're going to get started. Let me introduce you. Good morning, Susie, and welcome to A Fine Time for Healing.
Thank you, Randy. I'm happy and very honored to be on your show.
Thank you. I'm very honored to have you. What an amazing, crazy story you have. And not only with this particular situation that I focused on in the beginning, but throughout really the years, it has not been an easy run for you, has it?
Well, the answer is depending on how you look at it, right? You can either look at it that way, or you can say that every part of my life has been moving me towards a different journey and or a journey of understanding and growth. And so, I guess depending on how you look at it, that's really the only way I can describe it.
Right.
For some,
and
it
I
would
understand.
Be difficult, and and for others it would be, you know, well, these are the cards you were dealt, and now what do you do with it?
Exactly. And I completely get what you're saying. Sometimes when we're in the midst of adversity, it's very hard to see that.
No doubt about it. When you're in the middle of it, it definitely doesn't look like, oh, well, this is a gift from God and it's part of my journey. For sure not.
Exactly. So when we look back at your life and what you describe in your book, there's been a lot of hurdles that you've had to leap. Fortunately, you have integrated this positive message into your belief system, and which is giving you a great outlook, which I think is great for all my listeners to hear, because, as I said, when we're in the midst of adversity, it's very difficult to see this.
Absolutely, correct.
Tell us the story of what happened that evening and the next day when the kidnappers came to your house.
Well, I think you described it pretty well. It was Christmas week, December 21st, 1988. which was a date I will never forget. It's also a date my old life ceased to exist. In fact, I've told the story many times. It was obliterated. And, you know, as we know, everyone has a story. And in 1988, it was a huge year for me. I had just been married 90 days prior to this happening in my life. So I was married September 2nd. And then now 3 months later, I was only 38 years old. My life was upended. Really, our lives, because, you know, it was not just me, even though I went through a totally different experience than my daughter and my husband. But, there, you know, there's a fundamental idea in medicine and psychology that the path your life takes depends on just three causes. I'm sure you've heard it: how you manage your challenges, how you protect your vulnerabilities, and how you increase your resources. And these causes, right?
Right.
And these causes really are located in three places: your world, your body, and your mind. Well, in my case, all three of those parts were totally changed forever. And as you mentioned, my husband, Alan, and our last name is pronounced Levan, by the way.
Okay. Thank you for correcting that, Levan.
Sure. Was the CEO of a local bank, Bank Atlantic. And my 7-year-old daughter from a previous marriage. These three gunmen apparently had been casing other bankers' homes. And, you know, I don't think there are any accidents. It's something I've learned along the way. Everything happens for a reason, and I guess our home was the one that was chosen. And, of course, we were not home, and they knew that. And delivering this large poinsettia plant, they rang the doorbell. My housekeeper turned off the alarm, and now you had three gunmen in our home. Now, they were not just three gunmen. They were actually dressed in red, white, and blue. They were wearing wigs, they were wearing trucker's hats, and they were wearing sunglasses. So imagine opening the door to that. Had to be shocking into itself, and of course, we were not there at the time. So they proceeded to, I called my daughter at 6 o'clock every day when I was at work to make sure that she had gotten home and that everything was good and that she was having dinner, and I would tell her what time I would come home, et cetera, because I wasn't home. I was home most of the time, not home late every night. But that particular night was a monthly meeting that I went to, and we were going to be home late. So I called, and Patrona, my housekeeper at the time, picked up the phone, and it was a very strange call. She'd now been with us for over 7 years, and I knew her intonations. I knew her, the way she would speak. I knew what she would say, and something was just absolutely wrong with the phone call. And when I hung up the phone, and they were like one-word answers, can I speak to Lauren? Oh, she's already in bed sleeping. It's 6 o'clock in the afternoon. What 7-year-old do you know is in bed sleeping at that hour? And then, you know, is she ill? No. Did she have dinner? Yes. I mean, it just was one question after another that was just really strange. With no further, conversation about it, it was just very stilted, which, you know, now I would assume that there was somebody on the other line. But, of course, at the time I didn't know that. So I hung up the phone and immediately spoke to my husband and said, something's not right. I feel like there's something going on, and she couldn't tell me. And, of course, no matter how many times I tried to, repeat the information and how the call went, he kept saying, you know, I'm just a worry wart. There's nothing to worry about. I'm sure everything is fine. And so he tried to pull it out of me, but all the while I was feeling very anxious inside me, you know, a mother's gut feeling. And so we're now driving about 10:30, and we're in Fort Lauderdale and driving to Coral Gables. And we are driving up into our home. There was almost like a ridge to park the car where we were located, not far from Fairchild Tropical Gardens. And the house is literally pitch black. where normally the outside lights are on, the foyer light is on, the house is pretty lit up, and the house is literally pitch black. And immediately that just alerted me to say to Alan, something's not right. Do you understand? Something's not right. Everything is dark. And he, again, proceeded to say to me, well, maybe they forgot to, she forgot to turn on the light, which, of course, never happened. This was just a routine. And so no matter what I said, he kept, just pushing me, pushing my feelings aside, and I just allowed it. But all the while, I knew something was wrong. So he's now unlocking the door, and I'm standing behind him because I'm not next to him. I'm behind him, knowing something's not right. And now these men are standing in a dark foyer with a gun facing us. I now immediately start running and start yelling for help. And they come and get me and pull me in, and from literally pulling my hair, I have long hair, so they pulled me up from the ridge up into the inside the house.
Well, how frightening.
So now, I literally cannot even tell you what's going on inside of me. I can hardly breathe. They actually start, I'm hyperventilating, to be honest with you. Hyperventilating to where I cannot catch my breath. I'm hysterically crying. They've now pulled me in, my head hurts. And they have Alan face down on the rug in the living room. And they now throw me on the rug and say to us, just calm down. We're not going to hurt you. They actually got a paper bag so that I can breathe into it to catch my breath. I could not catch my breath. I look at my husband from on the floor, just terrified. Our eyes, catch each other. And we figured these are home invaders. We had no idea what they were coming to do. And they proceed to take my wedding ring, my watch, my jewelry, take whatever's in my purse. I had just cashed a check because we were supposed to leave town for a family vacation in 2 or 3 days. We were leaving for Christmas break with the kids. And so I catch my breath and they start telling us what they're going to do. They say to us, sit over here and here's what the plan is. And hopefully you're yelling and screaming and yelling for help. No one shows up and there's no police, because if there is, it's going to be a problem. It's going to change our entire plan. And so I'm a wreck. The next thing I say is, where's my daughter? I figured something's happened to her. And they let us go upstairs, and she is upstairs with Patrona playing on her computer and seemed to be very calm and very peaceful and not agitated in any way. And while I was up there, I was doing my very best also now at that point to stay calm and not freak her out and make her afraid. They now,
Were they behind you when you went up, when you went into the room? Did they follow you?
No, they did not. No, they stayed downstairs. And
did you think about putting sending out a message on, on Facebook or something like that, or you just were too
This is 1988. This is 1988.
Right. Okay. Right.
There are no cell phones. In fact, the phones that at that time were the brick, and maybe the ones that used to hang on your car.
Exactly.
Had to be installed inside the car. Well,
right. Well, you said your daughter was
available.
You said your daughter was on her computer.
She had she had one of those little, IBM PCs that are the baby ones. They used to have a name, Junior or whatever it was. Where you would play little games, the little game that would go bing bing bing,
right,
back
okay.
and forth. It was not a complicated computer, I can assure you. Oh no, this is way before all the video games and things of that nature. It was keeping her busy. Whatever it was she was playing, I don't even know, but she was on it, and it was tiny. I'm sure they were like tiny, useless little pieces of whatever were being created at that time. You know, and it was like a game. It was like having a little game on the table for her. So I looked at her. She looked at me. We hugged and kissed, and she seemed to be okay. Mind you, it's now late. She had her pajamas on. Petrona was now sitting in a corner, and she looked at me, and we kind of nodded like, I understand. And we proceeded to at that point in time, they said to us, just go to sleep. We'll be back and wake you later. Now, we had no idea when later was or what they were going to do. And I decided that I was going to be like a Columbo. And there were two of them literally at the landing on the second story. And I could hear them talking. And while we were downstairs, I started to watch, you know, if one was a left-handed person or a right-handed person, whatever I could see from the nose and the chin, their lips, if they had a mustache, if they had an accent, where their gun was, if they had, you know, what their shoes looked like. I said to myself, don't ask me where this came from. If the police ever get here or the FBI, whatever, I would be able to give them as much information. So I was making these mental notes all the while. My husband actually fell asleep under this incredible, you know, moment in time. How you could do that requires tremendous strength and power. And he literally was snoring next to me while I was wide awake, holding onto my daughter while she slept. And, of course, I didn't understand that at all. I was actually very upset and angry at him at the time, saying, how could you sleep during a time like this? But he later told me that the reason he did that was he forced himself to fall asleep because he knew the next day was going to be very, very difficult. And he needed as much ability and focus as he could conjure up. And he forced himself to go to sleep. Now imagine
that's
doing
unbelievable.
That.
No, I can't. I cannot.
Exactly. I can't do that when I need to sleep now. I mean, it's. So I was totally wide awake the entire night. So it's like 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock in the morning, and they tell us, go take a shower, get dressed. The mastermind, which was dressed in white, had now taken off his gloves and was sitting next to my bed, on my bed, using the telephone. And as I passed by, I heard a woman's voice that he was speaking to somebody because he's now wearing a wig and the phone was a little bit far away from his ear. And so I heard a voice. I went and took a shower and got dressed, thinking that we were going to, you know, be in the house, sit down, you know, have breakfast, whatever. And Alan was shaving and getting dressed and doing whatever he needed to do, just what they told him to do, that he was going to go to the office as if it was just another day. So they bring us downstairs and they give me the car keys. Alan had a 4-door Mercedes sedan, and we had parked the car facing into the doorway, and they wanted me to turn the car around. Mind you, it's pitch black outside. So all of us are downstairs now, and I turned the car around, and there was a telephone hanging inside the car. And believe me when I tell you, my hand was shaking, where I was saying to myself, should I dial 911? But I was turning, they asked me to turn the car around with the door open so that they can pay attention and watch what I was doing. So I knew that anything that I would do to possibly, you know, create another possibility of the police showing up or something would have killed us. So I made the concerted effort not to do anything other than park the car and, you know, back it in, and now the trunk is facing the front door. So I now get out of the car, hand him the keys, and he says to me, all right, well, you and your daughter are now getting in the car. So I kind of looked at Alan, and he looked at me, and I was, like, shocked. Like, how could this be happening, and why? Why are they taking us? I don't understand. And he said, well, don't worry. Well, you're going with these two guys. And Alan actually didn't understand either, and he got very upset. And he, so I opened the back door of the four-door sedan, okay, ready to sit inside, when the mastermind said, no, you're not going in there, you're going in the trunk. Now, take a deep breath. Yeah, you're going in the trunk. Now, mind you, never in my wildest dreams would that have even crossed my mind at any time. Mind you, it's 1988. There are no way, there's no way that you could pop the trunk. There's no, you know, little button that allows you to get from the trunk into the, because there are seats now where you can push the back seat from the trunk and get it out. If
right.
you need to, there's all
right.
sorts of different, you know, exits from the trunk now. But in those days, there were none. So now we are put into this musty trunk. Alan actually was kind enough to ask him, can at least we put a pillow? Can I get a pillow so that at least they can lie on this pillow? Their heads can lie on this pillow and at least have some comfort, which they agreed on. And Petrona went and got a pillow, and we are now inside the trunk, lying on a pillow in a fetal position. Now, what came to me at that very moment, and I'm doing everything in my power, not to be hysterical, not to be crazy, not to be crying, not to be shaking, which was happening all inside of me while this is now going on, what comes to my mind was, tell her you're playing hide and go seek. Because now my seven-year-old and I are going into the trunk of the car, and I tell her, I said, oh, honey, don't worry. We're playing hide-and-go-seek. Everything will be fine, and you're going to be with Mommy. So she totally bought it, and we're now in the trunk of the car. Two guys get in, and they start driving. So they drive, and 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 all we can hear is the little clippity-cloppity noises. We're getting a little bit of oxygen from underneath the trunk that is now coming in. Every now and then when they brake, you could see the red lights because it's pitch black inside. And all of a sudden there's a little light. And I start singing her songs, telling her stories. All the while she's hungry. She wants to go to the bathroom. She's nudgy. She's ready to get out. And I have no idea how many hours we've been driving or how long or where we are. I'm thinking we've been left to die in the Everglades when they finally stopped the car. And it's getting very hot in the trunk of the car because now there is no oxygen coming in from underneath. And I'm a little concerned about that. And what comes to my mind is we're going to die of either heat stroke or asphyxiation, because it's getting hotter and hotter. And, you know, today in Florida, you read about all these children that are left in the car. And
yes.
In 10 minutes, they're dead.
Right.
And here we are inside of a trunk with the same scenario, no oxygen and extremely, extraordinarily hot. And I say to myself, and again, I have no idea where this comes from other than being given these messages that I'm open to receive. And I say to her, why don't we close our eyes? Because Mommy didn't sleep last night, which of course I didn't. And I'm thinking, if we're going to die, at least let's die while we're sleeping, take our last breath, because there is no oxygen coming in. And it will be a peaceful death. You know, this is our coffin. This is a metal coffin that we are inside this Mercedes trunk, solidly locked in. And so she listens to me and says, okay, Mommy, I'm really tired too. And I'm sure it's oxygen deprivation as well. And I begin to pray. I close my eyes. And again, out of the blue, I begin to pray the 23rd Psalm. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He maketh me lie in green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters. He restores my soul. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I shall fear no evil, for thou art with me. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of my enemies. My cup runneth over. Surely in goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever and ever. Amen. And at that moment I said, God, Lauren does not deserve to die this way. Please take me. I'm prepared to go. And at that moment, Randy, I am literally physically, my soul, my spirit is leaving the top of my head and racing through this tunnel of light. I'm going at a million miles a minute. And I could see beautiful colors. I can see, and mind you, my eyes are closed. I can see these beautiful colors, and I can hear all these beautiful sounds. And at some point in time, I'm no longer traveling at that speed, and I slow down, and I am now surrounded by these beautiful beings of light. Now, mind you, I was chief operating officer of a public company for 16 years. Never in my wildest dreams had I ever thought about a near-death experience and what that would be like, or what that could look like, or even heard of the term a near-death experience. So I had no idea what this experience was, where I was, or whatever. And even having prayed the 23rd Psalm, the only time I'd ever heard that prayer was at funerals. So here I am now surrounded by these beings of light who are telepathically speaking to me. And to the right of me, I could feel this incredible energy and power and love. And mind you, I am surrounded by these beings of light, and I could feel this power next to me. And he proceeds to tell me that his name is Archangel Michael, and that he has been with me for many lifetimes, watching over me and guiding me, and that there was nothing to be afraid of. So even as I tell you this story, it's so vivid. My eyes are closed talking to you at this very moment, because I'm literally there. And I say to these beings of light, In my mind's eye, I'm speaking to them as I'm watching them and feeling them. And the energy of love is so there, and peace and joy. And the words just go on and on. And I say, am I dead? Am I in heaven? And they say, no, you're not dead. And you are not in heaven, but you are in a space where you are in between your physical life and your spiritual life, and you're in a different dimension. And where's my daughter? And they said, well, look down. And there we were. As I looked down, my eyes are closed, mind you, I can see my daughter, I can see me, and we're both lying on this pillow in fetal positions, still in the trunk of the car. And I said, are we alive? Yes, you're very much alive. And at some point in time, out of nowhere comes this whiteboard that creates a life review of what I've done, what I've been up to, what I've created, people I've loved, people I've hurt, people I've forgiven, people I didn't forgive, things that I've been holding on to, good, bad, and ugly, up to what I've done for the 38 years up to that moment in time. And this life review was very powerful, because it taught me that, or showed me actually, that there was no judgment, that everything that you get to see when you do cross over to the other side is that, number one, you are a being of light yourself, that you have lived many lifetimes, and that there is nothing to judge, because in fact you've asked for all of these scenarios and situations to be part of your life in order for your own personal soul growth. Of course, I did not know that at the time, but these are messages that are being given to me, and that no matter what I saw, that everything happened for a reason and for a purpose, and that I asked for it to be shown to me and given to me. So there was really, in the end, nothing to forgive, because it was something that I asked for. So that was a very powerful moment for me to learn about later on, and to obviously get to share with others. So now I'm still in this moment, and telepathically, I don't know how long I was there, being given information and knowledge to come back to my physical body to share with others when I returned to Earth. And as quickly as I had gone up at a million miles a minute, I am now literally turned around and now heading back the other direction, this tunnel, and coming back. And all of a sudden, out of the blue, I hear this thud, a big sound, boom. And mind you, my eyes were closed. My daughter was sleeping. And I open my eyes. My daughter starts to cry. And she points up to the upper part of the trunk. And she says, "Mommy, what is that opening? Look, there's an opening in the trunk." Now, mind you, that was the thud. And it wasn't me coming back into my physical body. But now there's an opening the size of a baseball over our heads, where now oxygen is pouring in, and the little particles that you would see, you know, through a window, you could see them clear as day. I could see the blue sky. I could see the clouds, the puffy clouds literally, you know, moving through, and oxygen is pouring through. And I say to Lauren, "Mommy was just with God and the angels, and I know that this is their way of making sure that we stay alive until Alan comes in and gets us." And she says to me, like only a seven-year-old would, is, "I thought we were playing hide-and-go-seek. I don't understand."
Wow.
So that, I mean, I was still in a moment of shock. I mean, I have to say, having gone through, this was divine intervention to keep us alive. It wasn't just a hole in this amazingly built, you know, metal coffin that we were in, where we were melting away and without any oxygen. And it was now being given to us to survive. So I knew that we were being protected and it all would be well. And a little while later, you hear cars careening and the tires screeching, and two or three different police agencies from Dade, Broward, FBI, Coral Gables, whatever, and the press, and you name it. And, of course, all the while, 5-6 hours later, assuming that we were no longer alive. Turned out the mastermind called Alan after they had driven off far enough away and gotten their money, and told them we were 3 blocks away from the bank, parked in a motel parking lot. So they unlocked the car, of course, assuming that we were dead in the trunk, and we pop out like a jack-in-the-box. Literally, pop out like a jack-in-the-box, because we heard the noise, and we're now getting ready to, you know, come out. So Alan's face and everyone's faces were something that I would never want to see again, but they were clearly shocked. And they immediately closed the trunk behind me, and I was ready to, you know, I was fingering the trunk, ready to show Alan how we survived, when all the while it was no longer there. the opening that allowed us to survive, the divine intervention that allowed us to live, to now be at this very moment, was no longer there. It was closed. The trunk was solid, inside and out. Yet both of us, Lauren and I, were shown the opening. She was the first one to say, "Mommy, look at this, look at that hole." And so we were not hallucinating, and it was real. And now it's no longer there. That was a huge gift, because, you know, you think, wow, what a beautiful gift, gone over to the other side, being spoken to telepathically by angels, by beings of light, by guides, by Archangel Michael, and now given this beautiful gift, this divine gift of keeping us alive, but not being able to share it with others, was pretty hard.
It is
very hard. But very hard. So unfortunately, you know, after being grilled by the FBI and the police and everybody else, I was so stressed that I don't know what happened, but at the same time, I gave them no information about my near-death experience. I was still in shock, and really just told them what I knew up to that moment in time. And they kept asking the same questions over and over, and they would have different people interview me as if we had something to do with this situation, when in fact we didn't. But, you know, what's really most difficult for me was that I kept everything inside, and I kept doing whatever I could to keep my daughter from being traumatized. And to my great anguish, even though we were very much now back out of this trunk, the kidnapping had extraordinary stressful physical, mental, and emotional side effects that took its toll on me. I did everything not to traumatize her, keeping her safe, singing her songs, telling her stories, trying not to be scared or afraid, not shaking, not crying. You know, I did everything, but the side effects were huge. So I became literally a broken human being, and I was suffering from post-traumatic stress syndrome, PTSD, which is, you know, a condition that is often associated with military men and women who are facing death daily. And now I was literally in that same place. And for about 2 years, I was at rock bottom in a deep, dark hole of hopelessness, despair. I was numb. I was physically, mentally, emotionally filled with all sorts of pain in every cell and every tissue and every muscle and every bone. I cried much of the time. I was in a rage much of the time. Nobody could help me. I could not sleep. I could not think. I could not focus. And my husband, in fact, had Wackenhut guards outside our home 24 hours a day. I was the prisoner. All the while, these people had now taken off and were doing this cross-country to others who did not survive.
And they took your husband to the bank to take out a substantial amount of money. Is that what it was?
$250,000 is what they were able to get out of the bank.
Which is why they suspected that you may have something to do with this, that you might have set it up, right?
Well, you know, I think that happens to anyone who gets in the situation where they assume that someone had, you know, something to do with it, where in fact we had nothing to do with it. But, you know, so they keep asking the same questions in different ways, 19 different ways to Sunday, to, oh, I got her. I knew it, you know.
Yeah,
and
right.
In fact, you know, we had nothing to do with it, and it was very difficult. So, I literally lived in this non-ending loop of closing my eyes, trying to close my eyes, and seeing these people in my mind's eye over and over and over and over. So I couldn't sleep. I couldn't function. I was like a prisoner of war in my own home, you know, like a POW. And the sad part is that nobody in my family understood. My poor husband did whatever he could to try and make me feel better. You know, men want to fix things, but he couldn't fix me because it had totally traumatized me in such a way that I was holding on to it and didn't know how to release it. And I was consumed and struggling, and I felt like I was being eaten alive. It was the worst 2 years of my life. And I couldn't escape it. I couldn't get rid of it. I didn't know what to do.
You know, what's interesting as you're telling the story, because I've been a spiritual person for a long time. I've done an immense amount of reading, and I've had many people on my show who have had NDEs. Every near-death experience is a little bit different, but yours is so typical of what they, how a near-death experience is described. And it's amazing to me because they say that the experience we have is based on what our beliefs are. But you had no prior conception of what this may be.
That's correct.
So, you know, and so that's what is really amazing to me. And it's really cool that Archangel Michael came to you. I've called him in many times.
he's
amazing.
He's a powerful warrior. And I call
myself
a spiritual warrior because of my Archangel Michael, because he's made me that and so much more.
That's amazing.
And yes, I call upon him a lot. But, you know, I felt like I had died many, many times. And, you know, not just from a near-death experience, but literally because I had lost so many things that were important to me as of that moment, in that moment, was that I was never able to go back to my home of 6 years. My husband had moved in with us, and so this was my home, and it meant the world to me, and we loved that house. And I was unable to go back there because it was just too paralyzing to me, obviously, by the events that had happened there. And I was never able to go back to work. I never went back to work. A job, a career I had for 16 years. So I lost that. I lost my family, in a sense, because they stood by me. They tried to be kind and understanding, but the fact was they really had no idea how to take care of me. And from the outside, I looked perfect, right? Nothing had changed.
Right.
I was not hurt physically. I was not raped. You know, so from the outside, they would say to me, "Yes, dear. Yes, you almost had a near-death experience." And I would say, "No, you don't understand. I had a near-death experience." You know, so it was really very frustrating. And so I was disconnected from them completely. And I was really, truly unable to be fully present with them because I did not have a group or a kumbaya group that I could turn to and heal. And I also lost my sense of safety and security because I was now anchorless and rudderless in the world, where before I had I was a totally different individual. I now really didn't understand what I was going to do with my life and how was I going to move on.
But you did a lot with your life, and I want to talk about that as well. I know that Lauren passed away at some point. How old was she?
36.
Oh, my gosh. I'm so sorry for your loss. That is, I cannot even imagine. So it wasn't, you know, we think sometimes that when we have these huge spiritual aha moments, our life is going to open up and change in these, you know, with this light on us all the time. But that wasn't so for you. It gave you the power to get through the experiences that you had. So tell me what it was like losing Lauren and how you are now.
Well, you know, I think that we are all given what we can handle.
Right.
And I also know and believe with all my heart and soul, and just being given so much information, having been on the other side, that there are no accidents and everybody has a life purpose and life journey. And time, when it's your time, it's your time. And so I'm of the belief that Lauren came into my life for me to go through this experience. Had it not been for Lauren, who was a child that was born 12 years after my first child, where I was told that I would never have children again.
Wow.
Because of a physical issue that I had. And then she came in, was born. And And without her in the trunk of the car with me, there would have been no reason for me to survive. I probably would have not survived. She was the reason why I kept praying, or I prayed. She was the reason why I was prepared to give my life for her. She was the reason that, you know, kept it, allowed me to live. And so I know that she came into my life for me to survive, to continue. And then it, when it was her time to go, even though it was the biggest, most difficult year and 2 years watching her, you know, go through her illness, she ended up having non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. But her illness is not what killed her. It was really a procedure that she had that took her life in 15 minutes. And I do know that she's with me. She's with me, sitting with me right now as I sit talk to you.
I'm sure.
And she's the one that was my cheerleader, my biggest cheerleader, always at every event, at every function, at anything that I did for the Work-Life Balance Institute and my conferences and my events, and loved the magazine that we also created, Balance Magazine. And she was the person that really pushed me to finish my book. I started this book like 2 years prior to her getting ill. And she kept saying to me, "Mom, you need to write the book. You need to tell your story, because you will change so many people's lives. And, you know, just please continue to write your book." And, of course, I stopped writing it when she got ill. And when she passed, all I could hear her saying to me in my mind, "Finish the book, Mom. Finish the book for me," which I ended up doing a prologue, an epilogue, which I did not expect to do, obviously, when I was first writing this book, or that she would be dead.
Right. It's amazing.
You know.
Yeah, it's amazing how those things happen. when I was writing my memoir years ago, something incredible happened that was just... It was a crime. I was the victim of a home invasion rape, and which was involved for 30 years. And as I'm writing this book, I get this call that they've got the guy 30 years later. So I was able to also include that into my book. So their timing to me is everything. We think that we control time, but that is not true.
You know, there is no time.
There is no time, and things happen when they're supposed to happen, and we're guided to do these things.
Yeah, absolutely.
So your book, you have been a philanthropist. Your book, the proceeds from your book are going to all be donated to charities: United Way of Broward County, Hispanic Unity of Florida, Nova Southeastern, which my son went to, by the way, Junior Achievement of South Florida, March of Dimes, Girl Scouts, Habitat and Humanity, Women of Color Network. So all your proceeds from this book are going to great causes. And so I encourage all my listeners to pick up a copy of this book and read this for yourself. And you will be donating to amazing causes as a result of it. So what does your life look like today?
Well, you know, it's really my life is about sharing my message. And the reason I wrote this book was because every time I did share my experience with others in small groups or large groups, and I had an audience only because of the Work-Life Balance Institute and my conferences, et cetera, people would turn around and say to me, "Susie, you need to write a book." And it took me 30 years to write my book. And it was a very cathartic experience, because speaking it, as you probably know, Randy, is one thing, but putting it on paper is so different.
Very different.
And opening yourself up and cracking yourself up to really feel what had gone on, and sharing your deepest, you know, suffering, because it's totally different. And, you know, people come up to me now and say to me, "I cannot believe, you know, how you shared your trauma and your loss and your darkness and, you know, your courage." and your strength. You're so strong. And for me, I think that we all are very powerful. I know that we're all very courageous. Each one of us has an opportunity to act or react in whatever form shows up for us. We never know when we're all going to be in a life and death scenario. And you know, it's not something you can plan for or train for.
No, absolutely not.
Right.
And you never think it's going to happen to you ever.
And you're a survivor, and you know, being a survivor and being a victor is so much stronger than being stuck in that negative feeling and emotion, and it could, you know, created all sorts of difficulty for me to heal. And so to heal and find the individual, Suzanne, who was going to be the person that was going to show me the way, if you will, open me up to see what was given to me and what my purpose on this earth was going to be. You know, I really became truly empowered, and I was able to turn the trauma that I had suffered into action to create opportunities for others and for myself, and to show them that, you know, through loss, everything I lost, through resilience, to understanding, and to forgiveness, understanding forgiveness now in a totally different way.
Right.
Having been given my life review, I now understood that there really truly is nothing to forgive, which is a huge aha, which a lot of people really don't understand.
Yeah, that's a hard concept. That's a hard concept to grasp for many.
Right, because we've been kind of, you know, religion and the way we've been kind of domesticated and trained that, you know, we have to forgive. And, you know, when you're betrayed or you're hurt or whatever the reason is. But the truth is that forgiveness is really for you and for you only. And it created such a sense of peace in myself when I understood it for what it was. And no matter how we are tested and what is shown to us or what is put in our life journey, we have to look at it as that these situations and people have put in our path, thank you, for a reason. And you have a choice to see it for what it is and grow from that experience, or be stuck in the anger and in the pain and in the fear and in all the things that come with it and suffer, or look at it as an amazing opportunity to now look at it with new eyes. And of course, you've got to suffer in order to get to the other side. I totally understand that.
It's so true. It is so true.
You got to go through your own dark night of the soul, go through all the pain and anguish, and then come out, you know, a whole different being and saying, wow, look at what this has taught me. Look at what I'm able to do now for others. Look at what, you know, what the messages have been shown to me that I can now share with the world. So, you know, it is a transforming scenario, but you have to be open to receiving it in that form. And so that's what I do speak about a lot, is the difference of if everyone has shown up in your life and given you an Academy Award performance, the one that you asked for, by the way, because you signed the soul contract before you came into this physical body, and your soul, in order to continue to grow, wants all of these things to be shown to it so that it can grow. Some
That's
difficult,
right.
some massively traumatic, and some easy. What, now what?
Right.
So what is there to forgive? What is there to forgive if you ask for it?
Right.
Nothing.
Right. I mean, I absolutely, I live my life with those exact beliefs, and it is very comforting, empowering, creates peace in my life. You know, there's nothing that I'm afraid of because I understand that it's all divinely guided. We're almost out of time. Suzy, thank you. I mean, your story is just mind-blowing. But your message is even more mind-blowing and extremely powerful. And I thank you for that, because most of my listeners are people who have had extreme adversity. Many are suffering from complex PTSD, which is PTSD that's gone on for an extended period of time, and are having a hard time getting out of the loop. So
right.
I thank you for, you know, sharing that message. It is extremely empowering for all of us to hear. And I wanted to ask you, so your book, Getting to Forgiveness, What a Near-Death Experience Can Teach Us About Loss, Resilience, and Love, is, I would imagine, it's available everywhere we can possibly
yes.
get a book.
Yes, you can order it on Amazon, you can Barnes & Noble, and any of your indie bookstores all over the world, all over the country. So, yes, it is available. And I was very lucky and fortunate for it to be a number one release in the near-death experience category on Amazon, like
you
a week after it came out. So
that
I thank everyone
difference.
Who has mm-hmm. connected with the messages that are in the book. And, you know, of course, I think just in closing, you know, we all go through pain and pleasure, confusion, but in the end, it's about your own personal enlightenment and connecting with the spiritual lessons that we're all here to learn.
Yes. What a great way to end it. Thank you. We are out of time. I hate to say goodbye, but I have to. And again, thank you so, so much for sharing your message with us today. It has been extraordinary.
Thank you, Randy. It's been my honor, my love and light to you and to your audience, and for speedy recovery for all of them.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay, take care. Have a great day. It is a beautiful day down here in South Florida. Enjoy it.
Yes, yes, it is. Let's enjoy every minute of it.
Okay, take care. So we are out of time, but if you have any comments or questions about today's show, you can email me at loveyourlife@randyfine.com. May joy and serenity always be yours. Goodbye.
We hope you enjoyed today's show. Visit randyfine.com, RANDIFINE.com, and be sure to sign up to receive updates on the latest blog posts, events, and upcoming shows. Thank you for listening.